This is my zine. Here's a story. Julius was in Tino's office. Tino was staring at his empty desk, avoiding Julius's eyes. Cook, the latest young twerp in charge of personnel, was looking him in the eyes. Julius was no more impressed by Cook than by any of his predecessors, and, being twice Cook's age, was not intimidated. This is about Anna Mae DeVito. Julius had not completed the funeral expense form on time, but the hang-up was clearly the fault of the undertaker. No problem. About her gratuity to you. One day, she had given him the only bill she had, a $5, and asked him to mail 3 letters for her, both of them knowing he wouldn't be back that day with the change. Was Cook really going to do him in for $4.13? It was possible, but even Tino wouldn't be staring at his blotter over that. Cook let him stew in silence, forcing him to ask, "What are you talking about?" On the defensive already. Cook told him that Anna Mae had left just about all of her $1,900 to him, and that she had promised to do so. Julius began to hear a pounding in his ears. "Did you know about this, Julius?" "The worst thing was, is, would be, to tell a lie. The old woman had mentioned something about leaving him money once and had laughed. He knew the size of her savings account. It was his job to." "Oh, she said something once, but this is a serious violation, Julius. We have to proceed according to the rules." He could visualize his name in the post, guilty of a small white-collar crime that hadn't happened. Less than 3 years from retirement, too. Cook cut the image off. "This is the form that states we have informed you an investigation is underway," he said, presenting the form and an expensive pen to Julius. Cook was trying to trap Julius into buying into a process that a clean employee would have no familiarity with, and Julius became indignant. "This is nothing. Nothing happened. Keep your form. I'll see the union." He stood and walked out of the glass-walled supervisor's office, re-entering the hum of the everyday, unaccused world. To reinforce that normalcy for himself, he leaned slightly over Marie's desk and asked her to get the 11:20 from Mr. Poveromo's file for tomorrow. "Sure, Mr. Gold." She didn't treat him like a criminal. With some self-esteem regained, he went over to his own desk to get back to work. As he sat down, Cook was in his face. "You have been suspended without pay. As per paragraph 8B, you have to leave the building." It occurred to Julius that using intransitive verbs was a cop-out. Both of them knew that Cook had first gone to Mr. Abrams, and the director had had no choice but to approve the suspension. It peeved him that this young functionary took the trouble to keep the boss's hands clean. When Cook spoke, the office had immediately gone silent. There appeared a picture in the back of Julius's mind of being escorted out, a security guard at each elbow. He decided not to argue. He thought to himself, "Them one, me nothing," and walked out, absent the usual papers, file folders, or even his reading glasses. Somehow, he didn't run into anyone on the stairs or in the parking lot, which was unusual. Everyone liked to say hello and give him a big smile. He got in the car and closed the door, but didn't start the engine. Where to go? If he got home 3 hours early, Rose would... No, she wouldn't. With Pauline, yes. He would have been made to feel like he had been sent home from school. But Rose was not so automatically critical. He would take her into his confidence on this. Not that her reaction would be any less predictable. She would tell him to fight back hard. but then she would let him do what he thought best. She had confidence in him. Pauline, as long as she lived, had always been pleasantly surprised when he did something right. He made a conscious effort to cut off this line of thought. He started the car and headed home. Rose was on the phone when he walked in, and she interrupted herself. "What's the matter?" Her voice was demanding, though she was not a demanding woman. "I had some trouble at work." Rose quickly said, "I'll call you later, Estelle," barely getting it all into the mouthpiece before hanging up and coming up the hall to the foyer, where Julius was looking at the mail on the little table. "Hunt, what is it?" "I'm suspended." He smiled more sheepishly than he wanted. Rose waited silently for his explanation. "You know that Anna Mae DeVito, my case that died last month?" "Yeah." "She left me some money in her will." "It's considered improper." He said the word as someone would taste something delicate, with pinky extended. "So, you don't have to take it." "I might have to prove that I didn't intend to." "You didn't know. How can they blame you?" No answer. He pretended to read mail. "Hunt," she demanded. "I knew, but I didn't know." "What do you mean?" And he told her. "That's nothing." "That's just what I told them. But you know how tight the ethics are in New York Civil Service." "Can't you say to them, 'I can't say anything now. There'll be an investigation, I guess.'" "I'll call Paul Farrell." Farrell was the president of the union local. "Here, call." And she started to lead him toward the kitchen, toward the phone. He followed, not for the phone, but for the food. "I'll call him at 6 o'clock. He lives in Weatherford, so he probably doesn't get home till then." "Where'd you put my medicine?" Rose shuffled things around roughly on the counter. On top of everything, those men had made her husband's ulcer act up. "Okay, Paul. Thanks." Farrell had already been told by Cook. Julius told Rose, "He makes it sound a lot more serious than I would have thought. He wants me to talk to the union's lawyer even before the preliminary hearing." "Don't tell me he thinks you did it." "No, but the amount involved puts it into a higher category. It's also going to be 3 weeks till the hearing." "Why so long?" "I don't know. That's out of my hands. There's nothing I can do about it." At 9:30 the next morning, Julius was on the phone with his daughter-in-law, Lynn, in Florida. He supposed he and Rose might come down for a week or so. Lynn knew something was wrong, since they had been down just 6 weeks ago, but she didn't inquire. She figured she'd find out soon enough. Julius suspected their sudden appearance would cause some fireworks, especially from Jeff, but with each passing minute, he felt a growing need to get away, even if it meant being a little selfish. On Monday at 1:15, Lynn met them at the airport. As soon as they began walking from the baggage claim toward the parking lot, she said, "Okay, what's going on?" Though Julius and Rose weren't smiling as brightly as usual, they showed no sign of physical problems. Nevertheless, Lynn was fairly sure one of them was headed for surgery, or worse. They had always planned their visits several months in advance, not 3 days. It was noisy with taxis and shuttle buses outside the terminal. Julius said, "I'll tell you in the car." This told Lynn it was him and not Rose. They walked to the car, put the luggage in the trunk, and got in without a word. Lynn turned to him in the front seat. "I'm under investigation."
"By whom?"
"Social Services. A client left me some money in her will, and they're calling it an improper gratuity."
"What could they do to you?"
"Fire me."
They could take your pension, declared Rose. No, they wouldn't do that. Paul Farrell said he only mentioned it as a legally permissible step. You'd have to steal $1 million for them to do that. Lynn was concerned that nothing had been said about guilt or innocence, and she didn't know how to bring it up. They were silent for a while. She played with the possibility that this trustworthy man had stolen money, or at least wrongly accepted it. She remembered the time Jeff had switched price stickers on a game at Toys R Us, in front of the boys, no less. She had never forgiven him for that, but he was her husband, and she was going to keep him. She became aware that she was going to keep her father-in-law, too. I want to tell you about a good book. It's called Snow Crystals. It's by W. A. Bentley and published by Dover. Only certain types of minds will like this book. It starts with a few pages of text about Bentley, who was a Vermont farmer whose hobby was to go out when it was snowing and take pictures of individual flakes. The bulk of the book is row after row of black and white photos of snowflakes arranged in order. What order? Read the book. I spent about 8 hours over a week's time reading the pictures, nearly 3,000 of them. There are no captions. You're on your own here, something like nature's inkblots, without the stigma of having to explain your thoughts to a shrink. By the way, it is not true that no two snowflakes are alike. I found 5 or 6 repeats, and I don't think they were the author's or the editor's mistakes either. Practical types may want to use the shapes for artwork, but this is an intentionally impractical book, the fruit of a lifetime's impractical hobby. Right on, W.A. Is there a number that means something special to you, but not to anyone else? For me, it was the number 4. There was a period in my life, several years really, where I had to do everything 4 times. If I accidentally tapped my finger, I had to do it in multiples of 4. If I burped, I had to force 3 more burps out of me. Ring a bell? 4 times. I think I was in about the 4th through 6th grades then. Mostly it had to do with motions and sounds. It's long gone now, but I guess it was something I was much preoccupied with then. I want to read you something, sort of an editorial, about the school crisis. I think I'll wait till the end to tell you which school crisis. There has been a lot of teeth-gnashing and name-calling over the school crisis. Careers have been made and broken, along with plans and promises for saving the system. But all along, the solution has existed, obvious in its sweet inevitability. We should do nothing. Let the shuddering, dying network of ancient buildings silently turn to ruins. It would be both merciful and proper. Every time there is a threat of a teacher strike, pious editorial writers and angry columnists get out their scrapbooks to see what they wrote the last time around. The refrain is always the same. It's the children who will suffer. Nonsense. The kids I know are happy. Let's face it, schools are dull, gloomy, depressing, repressive, horrible institutions. They exist for the welfare of the teachers and for the benefit of the adults who are too unimaginative to think of anything else to do with kids during the daylight hours. Schools don't work in any sense of the word. Kids don't learn anything. In fact, their reading scores seem to go down a year for every year of their confinement. And now we see that the bureaucracy is too incompetent to take the enormous amounts of money we give it, the biggest portion of our tax dollars, and spend it prudently. It is even too incompetent to keep the system running. The truth is that mandatory, universal public education is a 100-year-old experiment that didn't work. Before the Civil War, hardly anybody went to school. Urban school systems arose in the wrenching upheaval that followed the war, paralleling the growth of big cities. Parents coming from the farm to the city face the same problem that confronts their modern counterparts. What to do with the urchins while the grown-ups are at work? Do-gooders and educators like Horace Mann provided touching rationalizations for building brick warehouses for the little devils and creating careers for themselves, much in the same fashion that modern-day bureaucrats get rich from poverty programs, doing well by doing good. Parents shipped the kids off with the admonition that they were lucky to escape back-breaking sweatshop work, and that if they studied hard, they would have a better chance at life than their parents did. Of course, that was a big lie. The needs of business are not shaped by the educational qualifications of the workforce. It's the other way around. If all of us had PhDs, we'd all still have the same jobs that we have now. Extended education is only significant relative to the lack of it in others with whom we compete. Universal education, instead of giving its participants an edge, gives everyone the same edge. The result has been the escalation of the education game by ambitious parents forcing their kids to go to school for longer and longer periods of time, until now we have a generation with master's and doctor's degrees who drive buses and work as clerks. The whole thing was a fraud that benefited the education industry and the truly smart kids who learned a trade and made $20 an hour building schools. The school fad started around 1870. By 1907, the United States Commissioner of Education reported that the school's physical plants were 1% of the nation's wealth, twice the value of the telephone system, and a tenth of the value of the railroads. There were already more teachers than clergymen, engineers, lawyers, and doctors combined, and twice as many teachers as saloon keepers and bartenders. It's time to put a stop to it. Mandatory public education is a barbaric form of segregation that systematically excludes our finest asset, the youth of our nation, from all the vital aspects of society. The nature of work has changed. When work was all grind and grime and getting fingers cut off in machines 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, it might have been wise to keep the kids out of the workforce. But today, it's chic to work. Suburban housewives are rebelling because we crummy white males won't let them do what we do. And so are the kids. Throughout all of human history, except in the past 100 years, children have learned life by being part of society, working, and being with the family. Today's kids are vicious, spiteful little vandals because they resent being kept out. They want to know what's going on in the skyscrapers. Like other third-world peoples, they see on TV a way of life in which they are not permitted to play a part. Let's let them in. That was written by Paul McGrath. He was a columnist for Chicago Magazine, and the piece was written about the Chicago school crisis late in the 1970s, but I find that it's kind of timeless. I hope you enjoyed it. Now I'd like to read a letter from my friend Liza. We worked together at Powell's Books back in the mid-1980s, and she went to Africa after that, trying to be sort of a Diane Fossey, except the animal involved here is called the drill, something like a mandrill, a primate, doesn't have that colorful sort of rubber mask that the mandrill has. Anyway, Lysa was in Nigeria, and she wrote this letter in 1989. I'm out of the bush these days and spending the money which trickles into us from National Conservation Foundation, renovating a building for them as a headquarters and rest house, as they say here. We live in it with two chimpanzees and a drill and a rooster named Foghorn Leghorn, who will probably eat by the time you read this. We had a pangolin and let it go last night as it was searching for termites in the door jamb. We're organizing some educational programs for the villagers about conservation, wildlife, and trying to let people know what this new park will mean for them. Tourist money is a far-off concept. They eat monkeys and anything that moves here. It's pretty frustrating. On February 16th, Prince Philip, His Royal Highness, will visit us in his helicopter to dedicate this park project or our building or something in the name of World Wildlife Fund, who we haven't seen a cent from. Just think, royalty in our backyard. So we're trying to spruce up the place and hoping our animals won't pee on him. Watch the newspapers for me, please. I'm tempted to pull up stakes and hit the U.S., raising our own money while gorilla fever is high there, as I suspect. Liza was referring to the book and movie Gorillas in the Mist, which were popular at that time. Or is it waning already? How long do you think it will last? American public sympathies are so fickle. It's also tempting because I'm homesick and want to eat breakfast at Fuller's. Say hi to Susie and John there for both of us and have a waffle for me. Or we could pack the truck and go back to the Sahara or to Tanzania. Who knows? Except we have this animal family now. The rooster is in the house as usual. Calabar, a drill, and I just caught another mouse, the fifth in as many days. Another day in the life here. It's nuts, and I'm becoming racist to boot. Say hello to all our old buds at Powell's. Well, Liza and her friend Peter stayed in Nigeria, set up their program, and have been responsible for returning scores of drills to the wild. They did get funding from World Wildlife Fund and others, and have spent over 10 years in eastern Nigeria. The best tree I ever climbed is a willow oak on our place on Long Island. I didn't know it was called a willow oak until recently, but that wasn't important to a kid after school. This is a tree that is deciduous. It has leaves, not needles, but whose branches come out from the trunk at a 90-degree angle and don't curve down. They are close together, so you don't have to take any big steps. Unlike most evergreens, the branches start just a few feet above the ground. Our tree was about 40 to 50 feet tall and nicely rounded. Anyone who wanted to could easily climb up to within a few feet of the top in a couple of minutes. It was easy. It was tall. It was cool. And it was mine. I want to tell you about a store that I like. It's called the Woolen Mill Store. It's owned by Pendleton. It's not like their regular retail store in downtown Portland, nor does it sell the same Pendleton products you see at Made in Oregon or in the Pendleton mail order catalog. This store is owned by the Research and Development Department of Pendleton and sells clothes, blankets, and fabric in colors and patterns that are experimental or were decided against for one reason or another. Most are great. Some are not, depending on your taste. If you sew, there are quite a few bolts of fabric to buy by the yard. My friend Molly got a big bag of scraps to make a quilt or something, and she got to pick the one she liked best. That was dirt cheap. The prices on the finished products are low for a name brand. In other words, you could probably get a decent blanket from Brand X for less, but if you really want a Pendleton, you can get a twin bed size wool blanket here for $80 to $100. Comparable ones that they do en masse are $140 or so in all the stores. The Wool and Mill store is at 8550 Southeast McLaughlin Boulevard, behind the big Goodwill store, and don't confuse it with the Mill End store, which is right down the road. On a hot summer night, go to Taylor Street, the heart of Chicago's Italian neighborhood. About midnight, you'll find lots of people of all ages in the street. First, go to the beef place with its own little parking lot. Sorry, I don't remember the name. This place is strictly takeout and heavy on the cholesterol. You get a good-sized portion of thinly sliced roast beef stacked on Italian bread. Munch on this while you take in the street scene. Then walk across the street to Mario's Italian Ice Stand. If you aren't from New York, Philadelphia, or one of just a few other large older American cities with, or formerly with, vibrant Italian communities, then you don't know that Italian ices are the best of what a Slurpee is the worst of. They're true refreshment in a lot of flavors. Watermelon is my favorite food. It's officially summer when it's hot enough to want some, and it always comes through to cool me off. Being about 90% water and 10% cell walls, it is the perfect fill-me-up, but not out, food. It's healthy, too. The Center for Science in the Public Interest rates watermelon the most nutritious fruit of all, which is really saying something. It's also the cheapest food there that there is, as low as 9 cents a pound. Now, a lot of people in the West can't figure out what is really special about watermelons, and I understand why. Those round, striped, mushy things grown around here are poor excuses. The best melons are grown in the Florida Panhandle. They are a solid color, light green, and are long rather than round, and they commonly go 20 to 30 pounds. The meat is light red, not pink, and has a very slight crunchiness. And when you cut one open, a wonderful, sweet but fresh aroma tells you you have bought taste as well as refreshment. The seeds are uniformly black, not golden or white and soft. You can occasionally get organically grown Florida melons in Portland. Sorry, but I don't have a secret method of choosing a perfectly ripe melon in the store. Knocking on it doesn't tell you anything. If you shake it and you hear water slashing inside, forget it. If there are any dark green splotches on the rind, it is overripe. But otherwise, it is a matter of luck. Once I learned to accept this, the first taste of a really good one became that much more satisfying. Just the same, it is socially acceptable to buy a pre-cut half or quarter. Then you can see what you are getting, and even lift the plastic wrap and take a sniff. Some fools put salt on watermelon, and I once knew someone who would cut a little hole in the rind, pour in half a bottle of rum, then stick the whole piece back in place. You have to rotate it once in a while in the refrigerator for this to work. Speaking of refrigeration, as members of the cucurbit family, watermelons are naturally nearly 20 degrees cooler than the surrounding air. I can and do eat a 20-pounder in 3 days or so. Why not? Here's a major secret. I eat watermelon with a spoon. I don't know why, I just do, and it feels right. Another cool food I like is ice cream. I will tell you of two memories. The best ice cream I ever had was in 1960 at the Dairy School of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. It was strawberry, and I can still taste it. Cornell is the land-grant agricultural college for New York State, and I know there are others that produce and sell what they consider to be the best ice cream, but this is the best I ever had. The second ice cream story must be prefaced by telling you that my grandfather had a dish of ice cream every evening of his adult life. My father carried on the ritual as best he could afford to. If I hadn't learned about tooth decay, I would follow suit. When my father was a chicken farmer, he did business with an egg distributor named Ray. At some point, Ray sold his egg business and became an ice cream wholesaler. He moved to the other side of the same warehouse, so when we went to get eggs from his successor, we'd always stop in and say hello to Ray. One time, while my father was otherwise occupied, Ray led me to his walk-in freezer and opened the door. Just inside the door was a box about 4 feet tall and 2 feet across with no top. Inside, it was nearly filled with loose ice cream novelties, popsicles, dreamsicles, ice cream sandwiches, and so on. He told me to take one. I did. Next time, my mother made the trip for eggs, and I was along. Again, Ray took me aside. Yep, he still had that box of odds and ends, and he sure was stuck with it. He could only sell whole boxes of each item to his customers, and here he had all these singles. At just the right time, my mother came in. Now, she never had an argument with a sweet, or any other food for that matter. And unlike my father, whose practicality was even stronger than his taste buds, my mother didn't have to pay the bills. I smiled and raised my eyebrows. Ray smiled and said, "Just $10." And away we went. It turns out that what always seemed like a big freezer wasn't that big. My father was torn. He said enough to my mother to make her disappear fast. And he called his business friend Robbie, who took all the overflow to his own freezer for free. There went all the ice cream sandwiches. But I could see that this was the weakest, "You wasted $10" tirade he'd ever performed. In fact, he licked his way through it. My father set up a rule. One ice cream treat per person per day. It took the five of us over a year, at full allowance, to finish it all. And he and I still love ice cream. You probably know that daily newspapers print some of the sections for the Sunday edition earlier in the week. And in the advertising sections, sometimes they find in between times that they've printed a mistake. So the news section, the first section of the Sunday paper, sometimes has little display ads letting you know that there's a mistake in someone's ad further back in the paper. Here's one I found in the Oregonian some years ago. Notice: the 12-ounce Fisher mixed nuts advertised in today's Target sale section are described incorrectly. The ad states that the 12-ounce size does not contain peanuts. However, the 12-ounce mixture does, in fact, contain peanuts. We regret any inconvenience this may have caused. Target. You have to know that this ad was placed long before we found out that peanuts might kill a small number of people who are allergic. That puts it in a different context. Here's another story. Sarah shoots an alligator. A different side of Florida. Not the flashy East Coast, but the West, and 30 miles inland at that. For most outsiders, the interior of Florida is a blank space on the map, with the name Everglades. That had certainly been the case for Sarah, growing up in the Maryland suburbs. When she first met Kurt, hitchhiking in Ohio, he told her he lived on a cattle ranch in Florida, and she thought he was putting her on. Cattle ranchers were in Montana or Texas or someplace like that, right? Now, the trailer she, Kurt, and the baby lived in looked out on a vast, flat expanse of rich grass dotted with black and white cattle. And next door, her in-law's big house was the working hub of a real ranch. And this was home. All 4 feet 8 inches and 88 pounds of her felt just right, driving the pickup, riding a horse, and even using Kurt's rifle, though she only shot at pop cans, and only with Kurt's hand steadying hers. He was a real hunter in the family, and even he preferred to use bow and arrow on the white-tailed deer he brought home every fall. Mostly, Sarah was a housewife, and when they would talk slowly about Kurt's workday over dinner, she felt complete contentment. It would be fine if every day of their lives was the same. This must be the well enough in leave well enough alone. Kurt spent his days managing the Richards Ranch 6 miles west, while Sarah and Amy would spend time with Kate and the three of Kurt's sisters who still lived at home. Sarah felt like a guest in the big house, a guest in the most welcome sense. Her parents liked the Davises, too. Her parents liked any successful business people, and at 50, Raj Davis had been able to sell his electric supply plant and semi-retire here. Sarah's father even liked Kurt, now that his son-in-law's hair was about 10 inches shorter. It seemed a lot longer than 5 years since she had announced that, right after high school graduation, she was going to hitchhike across the country, and she might or might not go to college afterwards. She ruminated on this as she washed the breakfast dishes. Amy toddled around her playpen outside, right in front of the kitchen window. About 100 yards beyond, a steer suddenly ran a few steps, trotted a few more, and melted into a crowd. Some others began moving together in the same direction. Nothing unusual, but you always had to wonder about snakes here. Well, even if it was a snake, it would surely prefer the water and shade there by the ditch, wouldn't it? A few more dishes, another look out. That's an alligator, and it's a big one, and it's coming straight here. She had seen gators before, in zoos, and there was that crazy family in St. Petersburg that had 5 of them fenced in their backyard. Though individually, their movements could best be described as lumbering, the yard looked like a can of worms. And there had been that dead one on the road to Sarasota, big enough that Kurt had to swing into the other lane to get around it. This one is big, and it's coming right along, and there is my baby! Out she ran, grabbing Amy so abruptly the child cried out. Back in the trailer. Close the aluminum door. Close the wooden door. Can it climb the steps? No. It could go underneath the trailer, though. God, it could stay there all day in the shade until Kurt gets home. Call Kurt. No, he's not at a phone. Call Kate. Sarah knew Raj was away, but maybe... Would Kate say to call the police, or was there something like a dog catcher? Or just what do you do about an alligator? As she dialed the phone, her thoughts ran. She'd dial wrong. No one would answer. Kate wouldn't know. Kate would be too spacey. Kate answered on the second ring. Then Sarah heard herself use that understated tone she always did when overstatement was really called for. "Kate, there's a fairly large gator outside, and I think it might be interested in this place."
"Lock the doors."
I did.
"Where is it?"
"Just past the four palms." Silence. Then Sarah could hear several female voices at once. One, probably Kirsten, let out a short shriek. Another demanded, "Where are the dogs?" The big house had four screen doors through which the dogs nosed at will. Sarah visualized the dogs jumping around the alligator and the brown one, Buck, snapping at it, only to find the hide too tough to bite. She had a vision of the beast slapping away, no launching a dog, with a tail that she now saw was immense. The idea, but not the picture, of the long jaws snapping shut on a dog came to her. Saturday morning cartoons had never showed blood. Kate and the others bantered back and forth. The alligator was by now right by the driveway. It had stopped and was eyeing the pond. Would that be better or worse, she wondered. Rita came on the phone and said, "Somebody ought to shoot that thing." Rita was 28, and though she had grown up in Minnesota, she had adopted a strong cracker accent, to the amusement of her Florida-raised younger sisters and the dismay of her parents. So they went through the whole list Sarah had covered in a second. Kurt, inaccessible. Raj, away. Police, 30 miles away and probably skeptical. Animal warden, they're only in cities, silly. Sarah didn't really realize she was thinking rationally, but she was getting frustrated with the other women's chatter, which bounced between female hysterics and childish amusement. She thought of the rifle and mentioned it. Rita responded immediately, not with, "Do you know how?" or "Isn't that dangerous?" but with, "Do you have bullets?" Sarah didn't like the implication of "you" instead of "we," so she tried to come back with a sort of challenge. "Who's going to do it?" She knew it was no challenge before she had gotten all the words out, and the answer was inevitable. "You are." Sarah started to say, "You have to help me," but only got the "you" out. How could they help? Shooting was a one-person operation. Kate was on the phone now. "We'll be right there." Her meaning was clear. They would be right inside at the windows, with the door securely locked. Thanks a lot. The black thing was now in the dirt driveway between the trailer and the house, not 50 feet from either. As Sarah lifted the ammunition box down from the top shelf, she realized her hands were, if not shaking, somehow lively and limp at the same time. She felt her adrenaline flowing, and it reminded her of the time when that car had run a red light and she had jumped just clear. That was back in junior high school. Amy got interested in the sound of the bullets rolling around inside the box as Sarah set it down on the kitchen table. She took the child to her room and pulled the door shut. Kurt had taught her loading and unloading maybe 4 times, and she always forgot something. So when she found herself feeling confident, she didn't know if it had all come together for her, like swimming, or if it was simply that there weren't many steps to follow. What else? What can I do to keep from going out there? Nothing. Just do it. She stood and walked over to the window. There it is. It had moved a few yards onto the grass, and it looked like it might be sitting, if that would be the right word. But Sarah realized the thing's legs were fully extended. They were simply very short. Again, She thought of those pet gators in St. Petersburg and the way they scuttled about, like the people in a silent movie. How about shooing it away, even chasing it with the Buick? Now she faced the hard reality. For the first time in her life, she could die from her actions, but she had to take action. The rifle was appropriate. Could she just wait? Maybe it would just walk away after a while. Four pairs of eyes in the picture window of the big house were looking not so much at the alligator as at her, expectantly. She gently opened the inside door and tried to see the animal through the glass upper half of the outer door, but it was too high an angle. So she edged open the outer door, just enough to sneak her head out around the doorpost. The alligator was looking right at her. God! She jumped back, and the screen door slammed. She knew it would still be looking when she opened it again. She picked up the rifle the safe way, then realized she had done so. Okay, I'm thinking straight. Open the screen door. Reach across myself with my left hand to pull the inner door shut. Ease the screen door shut. Step down the first step. Now the second. Now the mound of dirt that serves as a third bottom step. She took one more step away from the stoop onto flat ground and turned directly toward it. Well, here we are. She had a notion to raise her right hand, palm forward, and say, hi, the way she did when meeting someone at the airport, when a hug was wanted but didn't seem to be happening. Where do I aim? The expression, right between the eyes, came immediately to her mind. It had the familiarity of 100 TV shows, but at the same time had a new, completely literal meaning. She thought of a Vietnam veteran on the radio recently, one who said he had wasted enemy soldiers, but hadn't applied the dictionary definition of wasted to their short lives until he was back home years later. She remembered to judge the range, but there was no question. The alligator was ridiculously close. She lifted the rifle and started to sight it, then realized the stock was positioned against her sternum. In other words, not positioned at all. She moved it to her right shoulder, nestling it below the collarbone. She made this move slowly and deliberately, and wondered if she did so to avoid spooking the animal, or to cover her mistake in front of the other women. Her eyes were already focusing on the little forehead, and she caught herself almost willing her brain to drop philosophical questions and get with it. She centered the crosshairs between its eyes. If the shot went high, it still might hit the long body. If short, it would hit the long snout. Maybe. What if it did hit it in the back? She remembered a story Kurt had told of a hunting companion who shot a wild boar. The thing hadn't even slowed down until the fourth shot struck its leg. The first three had lodged in layers of fat. What if she only hurt the alligator enough to make it mad? She mentally computed the distance to the picnic table, where she envisioned herself treed by the alligator. The creature lifted its right front foot, forming a black fist. Sarah fired. The gator's short legs collapsed, and its belly sank the short distance to the ground, slightly askew toward the right front, where the leg had curled under. With the explosion, Sarah was thrown backward and landed on the soft part of her backside. She had completely forgotten to plant her feet. She was up again in a second, somehow not quite sure she had heard the shot, and though she hadn't seen it collapse, she didn't raise the gun. Is it dead? Could it be? She considered how long it would take to raise the rifle, aim, and get off a second shot if it dashed toward her. A fervent tapping came from the window of the big house. She thought it was extremely quiet otherwise, and that it had been so before. She didn't dare take her eyes off the alligator, even though she heard the door opening. Rita said slowly, "Is it dead?" "Well, it's not moving." A small stone hit the driveway, short. "No, don't do that!" But another, larger stone thudded against the side of the alligator, just beside the head. "He's dead," Rita growled, in a tone appropriate for wicked witches and ex-husbands. Sarah was only starting to consider the possibility that the gator now was harmless, and weighed the value of shooting it again to make sure. Though she hadn't decided yet, she raised the rifle now, but Rita walked into the driveway, and Sarah lowered the barrel. Sarah approached it from its left front, opposite Rita. She stopped about 10 feet away, but then Rita walked right between Sarah and the alligator's mouth to its left side. She probed its upper lip with the toe of her shoe, revealing long teeth and glistening gums. "Ooh, gross," Sarah cringed. But a smile grew on her face, and she laughed and laughed. Here are the voices of four people who briefly became connected. "I don't know what to do. I'll be frank about this. I think I've stolen something. At the very least, I've let a misunderstanding go uncorrected, though I didn't intend to. It's all so confusing. May I explain? Just let me roll my chair over here. It's the chair, really, that made this molehill into a mountain, though I'd be lost without it. No, I don't think I'd last if I was still confined like I was right after my legs gave out. But even after 6 years, when I want to move, my first impulse is always to get up and walk there. It's like they say about people who move from one land to another. They may learn to speak in their new language all right, but they continue to think in the old one. So when I put the box on my lap, I wasn't thinking about the bump in the doorway. And down it come. Oh yes, the waitress was very kind. She was downright cheery about cleaning up the mess. She told that young girl to put in my order again, and I have to confess, I just knew something was going to go wrong. Didn't know what, though. I suppose I was a bit rattled by the accident, maybe that's it. But I should have known the girl would not understand about the onion rings. Oh, I know they're bad for my circulation, but I like 'em, always have. Don't tell me about restricted diets, young fella. Someone in a chair knows plenty about restrictions. I told the girl I'd had the Omniburger. She said, "Onion rings?" I said, "Yes." Hell, that's why I ordered it. Don't you see? It's the only burger that comes with onion rings. Wasn't till I got all the way home I seen she gave me a whole side order of the damn rings. Usually I check in the box when I get takeout. You know, mistakes can happen. But that damn waitress, soon as she seen the girl hand me the second box, she just rockets for the door, saying she'll hold it for me this time. Can't blame her. So I got all these onion rings, more than I can eat, for free, and I don't feel too good about it, 'cause I already put one meal on the floor. It was a losing proposition for the Omni, all around. Damn. There's this nice old crippled man who comes in every Friday for an Omni burger to go. Well, he isn't nice really, like some people, but he says please and thank you like he really means it, and that's more than most. Anyway, he come in 3 Fridays ago, like clockwork, and asked for his Omni burger. You know, that's a burger with lettuce, tomato, and onion rings. Well, he always carries it on his lap so he can use his hands to work his wheelchair.
and this time it fell off his lap in the doorway and spilled open. I felt so bad, 'cause he seems kind of shy and hears everyone looking. I don't know why people always stare when food falls in a restaurant, but they do. Gosh, it happens every day. Well, I just got him another meal, and that was that. But he hasn't been in since. He must be so embarrassed. Poor old guy.
Mike, it's not my fault. God, I never ordered up in my life. I'm only the hostess, you know. It was only my second day at the Omni. You know? Like, she told me to tell the cook to do this guy's order again, 'cause he spilled it. God, I asked him what he had, and he goes, an Omni burger to go. I was getting used to the different burgers like she told me. Well, sort of. I was pretty sure it had onion rings, but I asked him to make sure. No, I couldn't ask her. She was outside the door cleaning up the mess. Anyway, she would have gone, just do what I told you. Anyway, he says it does have onion rings, so I told the cook, an Omni burger and onion rings. Of course, he goes, where's this slip? And I told him it's a replacement for one that fell on the floor. God, he always looked at me like he hated me. I mean, come on. I'm glad I got fired.
Dumb kid. Boss says he's going to take $1.50 out of my pay for a side order of rings. Where does he get these kids, anyway? Yeah, I made up the order. She told me it was a replacement. Okay, accidents happen. But how should I know she's doing it on her own? They got to take care of ordering and paying up there. I just cook. Hell, turns out the kid didn't even know what a side order is. Christ. Here's something from a man named Jay Baldwin. He wrote it in the Whole Earth Review, formerly known as Coevolution Quarterly. It's about the Berkeley Tool Library. For about 9 years, the municipal library system of Berkeley, California, has been lending tools as well as books. Residents only, may check out what they need from the collection of such common do-it-yourself items as skill saws and ladders. If their address is on a HUD block grant area, there is no fee. Otherwise, there is a modest charge. Librarian Pete McElligott quieted commercial tool renters' protests of unfair competition by proving that he increased their business by referring patrons who couldn't find what they needed in the library's limited stock. How many people use the service? McElligott says that he serves about 35 people a day during the slow season, November to March, and as many as 100 a day, May through October. As you might expect, he also serves as an expert question answerer to many more. When asked if 9 years of this duty had frazzled his nerves, he replied, "No, I like it here, but I take a lot of vacations." What about ripoff? There is some, but not too bad, he says. Tools have been borrowed and traded for dope. Obviously, when somebody has to borrow a ladder, pry bar, and bolt cutters for the night, there is reason for suspicion. So far, a careful ID check has kept things under control. The tool library is funded by a government grant, but there is hope that it can be incorporated into the main Berkeley library budget. When that happens, the example may encourage libraries in less politically radical places to consider offering this noticeably useful service. On the other hand, the only other tool library I've heard of is in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, hardly a radical burg. Maybe all it takes is a little imagination. This is a good idea. What about having it in Portland? If you think Portland should have a tool library, well, get it started.